Welcome to the Rhode Island Liberty Report, your source for libertarian commentary on current events in the Ocean State and Southern New England. Coming to you from Rothbard Studios.
Welcome back, and here we are with another episode of the Rhode Island Liberty Report. I'm Mike, and with me is my co-host, Sean.
Hey, how's it going?
How you doing, brother?
Good, good. We're missing someone this week.
We are. We're missing our other co-host, Bill. He's out and about. Where'd Bill go?
He's actually taking a vacation with the fam right now to New Hampshire, but I secretly think that he's trying to see if the grass is greener on the other side.
Yeah, he's definitely scouting out New Hampshire, right? Like, I wouldn't doubt it. I would be.
Yeah.
I don't know how often I get online and I just look at property. Like, I've been looking at, and we've talked about this just, you know, offline.
Yeah.
But like property, New Hampshire, I look at New Hampshire. New Hampshire's a little expensive and it's getting a little crowded up there. So I've been going further north into Maine, right?
Yeah.
Like, so, yeah, it's just like a dream. Maybe my 5-10 year plan. I don't know.
Yeah. But, you know, I like hearing things like the Free State Project. If you guys aren't familiar with that, definitely give it a Google. You know, there's a lot of cool, you know, libertarian-esque initiatives going on out there. So that's why, that's why a lot of libertarians kind of point towards New Hampshire for a lot of good use cases of things going on.
Yeah, yeah. I lived in Alaska for 3 years. I was stationed up in Fairbanks in Fort Wayne, right? And that's actually, I got married when I was up there. My wife's from Rhode Island as well. But we got married and moved up there. And man, I love Alaska. Like, the winters are rough. The summers are great. The problem is it's so far. You know, it's so far from family, grandparents and all that kind of stuff for the kids and, you know, to move up there. But I think Maine's pretty close, you know.
Yeah.
Maine's close enough, far enough, but yet close enough, right? Like, yeah, so. And I'm not sure what Maine's debt looks like. I should look that up, but we do know what Rhode Island's debt looks
like. Yeah, absolutely. So let's take a look. See, as you guys know, every episode we try to take a peek at how much we're spending, how much debt we've got here. And we generate our stats from usdebtclock.org. Highly recommend checking that out at both the national and state levels. So for Rhode Island, we are at $11,777,000,000 in debt. Again, we're continuing the trend of spending more than we're taking in. Another $15 million in spending in the last 2 weeks. Jeez. You know, they're generating more theft, $11 million in revenue, which makes us, in basic economics, we are at a $4 million deficit, and that will end up hurting us. One interesting trend, and as we pointed out week to week, we're able to look at the debt per citizen, and it's been pretty consistent at $2-3. It's very slow, just enough where you wouldn't notice it in your wallet. Maybe it went up to $4 this time.
$4
in increase,
additional. Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So the debt per citizen right now is $11,128. We did welcome in a few more Rhode Islanders, but again, that's not bringing the debt per citizen down, and it's going up just a little bit every few weeks.
Yeah,
so that's an interesting trend. Again, unemployment is up about another 3,000. That's been pretty steady ever since we started keeping the metrics. Unemployment keeps going up and up and up. And you know, right now in Rhode Island, we're at 221,000 people. Jeez. Yeah, that's what the stat is telling me right here. And another interesting trend, it's trending a little bit more down, but food stamp recipients are going down. So we're about 128,000 for that one right there.
Interesting. Yeah. That's it. I'm trying to think of it. Another like Rhode Island institution closed its doors because they couldn't get help. And I forget which it was. You just kind of popped that thought into my mind. But, you know, the businesses that are just closing because they just can't find help. As we know, with like the LPRI meetup, what was it? 2 weeks ago?
Yeah,
we have that, you know, the initial place in Pawtucket, Murphy's Law in Pawtucket, which we've been going there for a couple of years now, just as a kind of a steady place to go. We had looked at their website before we planned the meetup, and they showed up as being open on Monday, but actually it was Bill who showed up. The door was closed. They were all locked up. They had changed their hours and closed on Mondays and maybe even Tuesday. I forget, but I don't want to hurt their business by saying they're closed on Tuesdays, if I don't know. But yeah, it's just crazy how businesses are having to do that now. They're just like less hours.
Yeah.
And how's that affecting the employees, right? Like, that, you know, that they're just the ones that are working, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's like that whole argument. I saw an article talking about, you know, we'll have to dedicate a dedicated article just towards like inflation and things like that. But, you know, the I think it was CNBC had reported that they did an article. It was like the silver lining of all the inflation is that everyone's salary is going to go up. And, you know, I'm going to steal something from Dave Smith real quick. And we'll talk a little bit about him in a second. But, you know, if you go to the grocery store with a barrel of cash, that's probably not the, you know, it sounds good on paper. Oh, I'm getting a lot of groceries, but are you, right?
Right.
You know, you could carry your wallet or, you know, a wheelbarrow full of cash. And we've seen real life examples of that, and it doesn't work out too well. But yeah, so a lot of the Liberty RI guys, we actually went out to a comedy show last night. Louis J. Gomez and Dave Smith and Zach Amico were in Providence for one night. And I'm going to tell you, it was a really good show.
It was awesome. Like my sides were hurting and like the you know, the back of my head was like just, I was laughing so hard. It was really, really good. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the trend from there, and we'll segue into one of the topics I wanted to talk about was, you know, there were a lot of people there. You know, I didn't see a single mask.
No, there wasn't. Well, not that I saw either. And you're right. I think they broke a record in the amount of tickets sold, and they didn't have that bigger tent, which I'm wondering if we're speculating, well, is it the tent because of COVID or is it a tent because they had more space and they were able to sell more tickets? So, you know, I don't know. I didn't talk to the owner, obviously.
Yeah.
But just to hit real quick, for those that don't know, Dave Smith is a prominent libertarian voice, in especially in podcasting and in media, Fox News a bunch. And he has a podcast called Part of the Problem. Big, huge podcast. I've been listening to him for quite a few years back when he was a small podcast, but a great podcast for those that want to listen to libertarian oriented podcast called Part of the Problem. And Dave's a real cool guy and he may run for president. So
yeah, that's the rumor on the street. So after the show last night, after we were hanging out, I was thinking about what to talk about this last episode. And, you know, just seeing that large crowd there, all those people there, it really made me think of the dynamic. And I talked about this a few episodes ago where, you know, all of a sudden the state said, hey, everything's good. And then people started taking their masks off all of a sudden. Right. So, last week we celebrated Independence Day. And I live in Bristol, so the town goes all out for 4th of July. Yep. Starting after Flag Day. And if you guys haven't made it to Bristol on the 4th, definitely recommend checking it out next year. It's always been a good time for me.
I'm going to counter that just because I grew up in Bristol. and I've been going to the parade for many, many years. When I moved away, I missed the parade, right? I missed that whole party scene, especially as a young guy. And then we moved back with the family. It was kind of fun for a while. And now I'm just like, I'm done.
Yeah.
we went to Prudence Island where it was very quiet. They had about a 10-minute fire truck parade where you threw water balloons at each other. And it was so... Maybe it's an age thing. You might outgrow it.
Well, I'm still a young Bristolian. That's right. I think they call me a carpetbagger.
Yeah. Okay.
In the comments, but every night they have a concert series with a lot of people out there. You know, they had a carnival there for multiple nights, and I took my family there, and it was loaded with kids and adults. You know, the 4th of July parade had 2 miles straight crowded sidewalks on each side. Hardly saw a single mask at any of that stuff. So I want people to kind of paint that picture there because it all seemed very normal again. All right, we could go down the route of all the irony, you know, for Independence Day, right? What we've witnessed from a national and even the state level. And we should probably talk about that a little bit in this episode. Yeah. But, you know, in essence, we're celebrating the overthrow of a tyrannous government. And remember, for, you know, Independence Day, treason is... or the season is for treason relative to that. And it seemed like a couple months ago, we just got over some of the most outrageous overreach from government, you know, where they imposed lockdowns, stay at home orders, executive orders that gave the government excessive powers at state and federal levels. It crippled our economy. And we observed, you know, one of the most concerning, the largest transfer of wealth in modern history. And it seems like, again, a couple months ago, everyone was just okay with it. And it was ironic just seeing everyone waving the flags and standing shoulder to shoulder to celebrate either the country or independence. And everyone was okay with all those lockdowns and all that stuff. And now that they have permission, you know, I think Joe Biden said you could have a small barbecue or something like that. And
something about 16 cents, wasn't it?
I did notice that in my wallet this time around. But it was all framed under the guise, right? Like all the restrictions and lockdowns. Like if you didn't do all this stuff, you're going to kill grandma. But if you guys do what the administration said, you can have that small barbecue. We'll save you that 16 cents. I found it odd and concerning, really, the precedent that was set with all that, you know, that many folks are still relying on the government for these types of signals. And it really shows how strong the nanny state is in Rhode Island.
Yeah.
You know, we talked last episode that most of our funding, you know, comes from the federal government. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's no surprise there. You know, I just found it very ironic, you know, seeing people celebrating the 4th in contrast to all that. I don't know if you had any other thoughts relative to July 4th or anything like that.
No, it's the same way for me. I think people just don't connect it to anything. It's just another day to have a party, drink beer, and, you know, have a cookout, right?
Like, yeah,
you know, kind of goes along with like Memorial Day, where it's just another day to cook burgers, not really thinking about what it represents.
The real context, the real cost
of American, you know, foreign policy. It's a little depressing to say the least. But it is nice to see finally the kids are getting out and interacting with each other and having a good time. Like that kind of warms your heart a bit, right? I was saying, I made a comment. So we went to a family member's house and we were sitting, getting ready to light our own, do I want to incriminate? I didn't buy them. So we're getting ready to watch somebody light some fireworks, that they hadn't gotten. And, you know, I looked, you could, you know, see around the bay, and it was a little heartwarming to see all the acts of civil disobedience that are going on, you know, aside from the local town stuff. That was kind of, interesting. But then you had all the other, you know, the Karens on Facebook complaining about how their dog was hiding under the couch and shit like that.
You know, the interesting notion there is, you know, despite seeing all that stuff, you know, no masks, parents and kids and grandparents and strangers all coming together, which, you know, a couple months ago you would have been shunned for. The government said we're not done yet. You know, despite we've, you know, McKee I think he came out and said that Rhode Island was like number two in recovery or something like that, just in terms of the raw regulations or the lifting of restrictions. And if you guys remember last episode, we said the budget had some provisions for limiting executive powers during declared emergencies. So that did go into effect finally when McKee signed the bill for the budget. The most important, just a recap, the most important language from that was the restriction on emergencies for 180 days. And some of the executive orders were sunset upon signing that, so that was good. But he can continue to extend many of the ones that are still there, and he did. And until he can keep doing it until the moratorium for those in September. If they go away, he can just bring them back in if, you know, the Delta strain or whatever comes back in. So that also comes with that 180-day kind of cap for that type of stuff, if the General Assembly, you know, wanted to try to stop some of that stuff, you know. But despite low rates of COVID infection and hospitalization, they keep pushing it. So, you know, just to put into context, Gina Raimondo declared that executive order March 9th, 2020. And even though he's touting all this stuff where we're seeing reduced rates across the board and everything, where he just extends it. He claims, oh, it's for a lot of the post activity, but really it's, you know, securing certain types of funding, being able to do certain things, continue to overstaff a lot of departments outside of the budget. Like they're bringing in a bunch of retired people from the Department of Labor, Department of Health to like do these additional activities. And I found that was very odd. But, you know, one of the things that was terminated this week, executive orders, was actually the government mask mandate. And I thought this was interesting against the guidance of the Department of Education that was put out. And most recently, the CDC, they put out the information towards kids in school and mask wearing. And I'm curious how it's all going to work out to really put it out there. You know, McKee had put out recently that this fall, learning is going to be fully in person. School districts don't have to set up for any sort of distance learning plans to get approved by the state. And it seemed to defer to local school districts on how to handle a couple things. So I looked into a couple of things. If you're riding a school bus, for instance, I guess there's some federal regulations behind that. And, you know, everyone,
DOT type things.
Yeah. And people still have to wear masks regardless of status. They have to keep the windows rolled down, that kind of stuff. They did indicate that fully vaccinated kids were free and clear, don't have to wear masks indoors this fall. So that's kind of been the reoccurring thing. Like, hey, if you're vaccinated, you can go do this, right? And school districts are going to have to develop their own policies. After Rhode Island took that type of stance, which I thought was okay. We'll talk about that in a second. Yeah. But again, the CDC came out and said, hang on a second. We recommend all kids two and above If you're not vaccinated, you should be wearing masks indoors. So I think what's going to be interesting to see the contrast between that. And I have mixed feelings about some of that. So at first glance, I thought, hey, it's okay for the state to let the communities or the school districts decide some of those nuances. But the more I thought of it, I really thought it was a cop-out for McKee not to take a hard stance on that type of stuff. If anything, he should have put out, you know, what I would have thought is it should be up to the individual. It's funny, at the end of the pandemic or towards the end, they're like, oh, now is when we're going to take personal responsibility and things like that, which we should have done from the get-go. But now, they're indicating what I think is they should indicate that it should be towards the individual, you know, or, you know, the parents of the kids should be making that type of decision, whether they wear masks or not. You know, so now it's going to be placed in the hands of school committees and districts. And I think we're going to see some hypocrisy here. And I say that because the same people that, you know, traditionally advocate for things like proof of vaccination relative to COVID or forcing decisions onto your children in order to attend classes, right, which I kind of chokehold you on that. Yeah, I guarantee some of the same people were at the carnival I was at the 4th of July parade that I was at. And, you know, at this point, what's the difference at this point? You know, so I want to know what you think about this, Mike. So here's my stance. You know, I think people should treat it like they do now when they go to Stop and Shop. You know, when you walk in, you have no idea if someone's vaccinated or not, right? You know, in that case, you should take, I think, the appropriate level of responsibility and protection that you feel that you need as an individual to put yourself in that situation. Whether that's to get the vaccine, wear 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 masks at a time, or whatever you feel like you need to do for yourself, you should do it. Yeah. Just don't force someone else to do it, because when you apply principles, you should apply them broadly in that.
No, I agree with you on that 100%. I think, in all honesty, I think it's a good opportunity as a teaching moment for your kids, right? To teach individual responsibility.
Yeah.
Not only you make that, help them make that decision, but then you go forward with that decision and use it as a moment to say, hey, look, here's our situation. Here are our risks. Here's how, you know, and come up with a methodical way to make a decision, and you can use it as a teaching moment for your children, right? Like if your family feels that you are safer wearing a mask, then you can have that discussion with your kid. Whereas you can also have the discussion on the other side of that, right?
Thinking. Yeah.
And and I don't know if this is the point to talk about it, but we talked about who, you know, the reality of the risk for the kids, right?
Yeah.
And we had searched some of that information, and there's been no deaths for COVID related deaths for below the age of 24 in the state of Rhode Island. In the next demographic up is 25 through 29, and there were 5, and then it goes up from there. And then when you do look at that, at those demographics, 80 plus is where the huge, you know, risk pool is. But you know, we already know the data. Not again, that's not to say no child that has underlying health conditions, which they would have regardless of what the medical situation is, and they're gonna have to live their life, you know, making decisions based on that anyway. But the reality is, you know, if the kids do get sick and they build up and they have very low risk of having any potential, you know, fatal reaction to it. And then they build up a natural immunity. And you know what I'm saying? It's like, so there's this, you know, are we doing more harm by sheltering them too much?
Right.
Like yeah, I don't know what your thoughts are on that as well.
Yeah, so it's interesting. And those kind of numbers when we were looking at it, right on, you know, the Department of Health's website, I thought that was really interesting, because a lot of these things that people are championing for, or they will, what I think the discussion is going to be until the fall is, you know, this is supposed to be for the protection of the kids and all that stuff. But if we're looking at the raw numbers, it doesn't look like the children in our state really have been impacted this from at least a fatality perspective. I mean, we could look at some of the, you know, the carrier rates and things like that, but it seems almost a moot point at that point. The other side of that argument was, oh, you know, for the staff, right? Because they may not be affected, but then they give it to the staff. I think the statistic that McKee put out said 90% of teachers and staff are fully vaccinated in our public schools. So I feel like we've done a whole lot to mitigate that type of thing. So it seems like we are ready to, you know, if we're going to fully reopen, we should fully reopen.
And again, that that individual staff member has to take on some responsibility for themselves and decide whether or not they want to, you know, be exposed or deal with that risk. It's you know, and then the other thing is, we know masks is nonsense, right? I mean, that's kind of, that cat's out of the bag now. And it's just nonsense. It's a virtual signaling tool where people, I mean, we saw what happened when people were like, I'm still going to wear my mask because I don't want to be, you know, we talked about this, you know, a couple podcasts back. But so it's kind of nonsense. And then the other part of me on this whole thing is the indoctrination side of it, right? Like, so yeah. We're teaching these kids to be compliant and all that stuff. And I just finished reading a really good book called Dumbing Us Down by a guy by the name of John Taylor Gatto. Quick read. I think it was on a couple hundred pages. Easy read. And he was a New York City school teacher, actually. And he talks about how it goes into the whole, you know, Prussian model of education and what it's really doing to and how it sickened him. He's since passed away, but very interesting book if you want. But just coming off of that, reading that book and seeing what's happening to our kids, you know, it's a little worrisome to be.
Yeah. You know, something I didn't really consider, but I wonder if schools are going to push forward with this to try to get funding. Now, I wonder if they, you know, they've been spending a lot. They've been making a lot of investments. I don't know how many more that they need to make in any of these protections, but they've definitely gotten more funding. Mm. And now towns and the state are trying to realize some of this budgetary stuff. And a lot of that funding from the federal government specific for that is going to start to dry up pretty soon since we've been reopening. So I'm very curious, and I don't want to be in that mindset of, yeah, they would do that just to keep getting the dollars to come in. But, you know, they hired, I think, a bunch more staffing to account for, you can't have class sizes as large. So now you may have an influx of that. And I wonder if there's going to be some sort of, opportunity or, you know, realization that maybe they got a little bit too bloated during all this and now they don't know what to do.
You know, that's just government in general does that, right? And I'll just defer back to my experience in the military. October was our fiscal year, right? October 15th, if I remember right, was the end of the fiscal year. So, you know, the battalion was allocated an X amount of, dollars and or X amount of rounds of ammunition to spend for the training cycle, for the training year. And at the end of that fiscal year, it was a use or lose thing, right? If you didn't use up all that ammo, you wouldn't get it for the next year. So we did what they called spendex, right? Like, you'd go out to the range and you'd just blow off ammo. It was like they made up stupid training just to get rid of the rounds so you could then get that same allocation for next year. But you didn't spend it this year, but you might need it next year kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'll never forget. We had a flatbed truck pull up to the range stacked with, they're called AT-4s. It's like an anti-tank rocket, like a bazooka. Like, it's the modern equivalent for those that aren't familiar. And I don't know how much they cost. They got to be tens of thousands of dollars a pop. And we, from morning till it got dark, we were just like trying, like doing all we could to shoot as many of these things off as we could because they were, you know, anyway, but to your point, that's my own personal experience with the government is going to give a damn. They're going to try to keep that money flowing.
Right? But it seems like that same principle can be applied to most applications of government right there. Yeah. Right. So if you don't spend it, you're going to lose it.
Yeah. So they got to keep it going. Keep that money train.
Yeah.
Chugging along.
That's crazy. But, you know, I think this, you know, the mask or non-mask, I've heard of some individual groups coming up with some initiatives trying to influence and persuade, you know, town councils, school committees to, you know, let the kids go maskless or at a minimum make it, you know, not to say, oh, no, your child can't wear a mask, but let it be the parent's choice. Let it be the child's choice. And I think that's the stance that I take. And I think it'll be interesting to see the dialogue over the next couple months because they're going to have to figure it out sooner or later.
Yeah. So,
speaking of things,
go ahead. Just one other thing that just worries me is mandating vaccinations for children.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not one, I kind of push back on people who claim that, well, it's not FDA approved because I don't think the FDA should exist anyway. But the point is it's an experimental, vaccine, right?
Yeah.
And, so I worry about, you know, giving that to a child. You know, adults can make those decisions for themselves, especially older adults that are at the end of their, you know, we're coming to the end anyway. So, over the hill, so to speak, but, so you make those decisions for yourself, but we don't know what's going to happen to developing children, right? Like that's something that worries me a bit. I'm not a doctor either, so I don't.
Yeah, you know. Well, you're not a doctor, but you're not elected in our General Assembly either. But they've been pretty busy, huh?
Yeah. So I don't know if anybody follows the Rhode Island General Assembly, I think, or Rhode Island State Representative Facebook page, and they post a bunch of propaganda.
Well, let's just say they've been really active this session.
They must have a new social media person, yeah. I'm guessing. But yeah, so I just. Of course, it's one of those things like you're flipping through your feed and your blood starts boiling, right? Like, I'm like, I'm not here to get pissed off and be angry for the rest of the night at this nonsense. But I did find some amusing, some actually quite frightening examples of legislation that just recently passed through the General Assembly. Of course, the end of the session, right? They have that mad dash to get as much stuff through. And it never ceases. It happens.
Is that effective, though? Do you think that they're really like taking the time it takes to read through the bills and consider everything when they go on these mass voting sprees at the end of the session?
No. There's no debate that takes place. It's just like, we've got to get this done. You know, and it's insanity.
Especially with it. And I'm trying to think of what Bill would say right now, if you're listening, Bill. Yeah. But, you know, that's something where, you know, you'd want to stop, especially after the year that we have where there hasn't been a whole lot of transparency. You know, take care of business, do what you got to do, and really start looking next session when things are opening up, when we can actually go through the different processes to be able to adjudicate all these. I don't think any of these are crazy or bone breaking or, you know, anything bad in the state's going to happen. If something didn't happen. So there should be ample time to review, consider these things. You would think, you know, with all the time they had on their hands, they could review it, but the kind of the opposite thing happened during this. So yeah, you know, just an interesting nuance there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm also, before I start going down the list here, of the opinion that I'd be happy if they just went up there and did nothing.
Yeah.
you know what I mean? Like, there's this attitude, like at your day job, right? You go to work, you have to do work, right? Like you get hired to do work. I'd rather hire legislators to do nothing. You know, like if something pops up and they need to take care of it, they take care of it, but I'd be perfectly happy. It's almost as if they feel like they have to do things, right? Like they have to have X amount of pieces of legislation per term and all this other nonsense. But anyway, that's just my take.
Well, it must be the constituents that are banging at their doors over all these, right?
Well, that's how they keep their voters going too, right? Like they and then all their, you know, pandering that they do, and you know, I passed X amount of bills for, you know,
I did this for you. You're
exactly.
Welcome.
Yeah, exactly. So the first one that caught my eye was a tax exemption, which as a libertarian, I like tax exemptions. I think everybody should have a tax exemption 100%, right?
Like, absolutely.
100% tax exemption. And it's funny because, you know, even within libertarian groups, there's sometimes a bit of a back and forth on tax exemptions. People call them subsidies. When a tax exemption is different from the subsidy, a subsidy is kind of when the government takes money and they distribute it to somebody else, a private business or whatever. Whereas a tax exemption is they're not taking that money, right? So I think a tax exemption, even if it's for a specific group, is beneficial. It's less money in the government's hands, but it's also an admission of the fact that they're using these taxes to stroke their constituency, right?
Like, yeah.
So this tax exemption is for artists. And there's already a tax exemption in Rhode Island, which I didn't know this, but in multiple communities, I didn't put the list down here, but it's, at least, I know like Warwick, all the major metropolitan areas, Warren is one of them. Like a lot of these, a lot of cities and towns have artist zones, what they've declared as art districts, and people who live in those artists that live within those districts can get tax exemptions.
Mike, are we considered artists right now?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Like, what do I have to do to become an artist, right? Like, can I can, you know, use a crayon with the best of them. But so this one extends to, they've expanded it into East Providence. So the tax exemption will come into East Providence, and it was Representative Brianna Henries and Senator Valerie Lawson, which sponsored these bills. And it grants a personal tax exemption for writers, composers, artists residing within the East Providence Art District, which is down kind of, what's that, Roger Williams Ave, down near the water on that side of East Providence, down the river.
Okay.
And it describes exactly kind of the actual boundaries of this artist zone. But East Providence has a thriving art scene, which adds to the city's already rich community and culture. We have been We have seen the success of other art districts, which have had in the state, and this bill is bringing the same success, culture building community, East Providence, making East Providence stronger in the process, says Henry's. It's interesting, right? They're saying that they need artists in the communities to help, you know, build the community. And my thinking is, if everybody had money back in their pocket, for one, they'd have more money to spend on art, you know?
Yeah.
So just having more money in your pocket would help build their community. So why are they targeting a specific group of people, right? The other thought is, we always hear the story of the starving artist, right? Mm-hmm. How many of these artists are actually paying taxes to begin with?
Yeah. Seriously, you know, I think with this, Mike, we need to move the podcast studio. I think that's what their intent is, to be like, oh, well, if we do this exemption, then all these artists are just going to flock to East Providence all of a sudden. So maybe we need to consider moving the studio.
I wonder where we would fall in. Are we a writer, composer, or artist?
Oof.
We have to figure out where we would fit into that. Into those categories. But I just find it's just bizarre to me that the government is getting involved in this. Like, it just boggles my mind. They have it's not the function of government to get involved in this. It just boggles my mind. And if this is going to grow something, it's going to actually, you know, make this thing grow. Well, then the people that are still being taxed are being held back. Right. So you're holding other people back.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't tax mechanics, you know, that industry could grow. If you don't tax, you know, house painters, you know, are they artists? I don't know. Maybe if it's only painting a house in the art district is that.
Oh, that must be it.
But you see what I'm saying? Like it's very bizarre that they target one, you know, segment of or group of people and, you know, with admitting that this will help that group of people, but they don't. You know, they can't apply that to everybody.
Yeah. you know, if they did, I have a sneaky suspicion that people would have more money in general to spend on art. So I think you would see a inconsequential increase in art spending in East Providence if you just stop taxing people like that.
That's exactly right. Right. Like, when people have more money in the pocket, they spend it on other things. It's just, it's just very bizarre. That was one of them. The other one, the weather, right? It's not very sunny today, but the sun's going to come out sometime, right? to quote the crow, right? Sunscreen. So as it stands right now, your child is not allowed to put sunscreen on their skin while they're at school without the permission from the nurse. They have to go to the nurse to get sunscreen.
That is wild.
It's freaking bizarre.
What's even more wild is that the state, like, someone went through the process in the General Assembly and wrote some sort of restriction saying we can't do this. We do not want our children to wear this.
Yeah. So this legislation is so that students in Rhode Island schools will not be denied the right to possess and apply sunscreen. Talk about it, the nanny state, right? So the legislation, proposed by Representative David Bennett, who's a nurse apparently, and Josh Miller, who is a scumbag. But the legislation ensures that students as well as teachers and parents on school property. So I reading this now, I didn't get into the weeds on this, but the way I'm reading this, if this is now required to allow parents on school property and teachers, do they also have to go through the nurse currently before this bill gets signed by the governor?
Yikes.
Right? So, school property, so teachers and parents on school property or at school events will be allowed to have and use sunscreen at school, despite state regulations that prohibit anyone other than a school nurse from administering medications, including Food and Drug Administration approved substances like sunscreen, or possessing them without a doctor's note or prescription.
You know, instead of writing a bill, they should have just one-lined the whole restriction and say, yeah, this was dumb.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of writing something that's going to be put into place and then likely amended in the future or a template for something else, they should have said, hey, this is really stupid, and just one-lined the whole thing and called it good.
Yeah. I just also found it interesting that they specifically put in the language, as long as the product is regulated by the FDA for over-the-counter use.
Goodness.
So not only is the government telling you like that you can, we're giving you permission to use sunscreen now, but it has to be government-regulated sunscreen.
This one's cut and dry. I mean, any normal common sense person would be like, yeah, this is silly. But not only that, it's that aspect there, right? With the whole, well, you can do it, but you have to use what we say is good for you.
That's right. Yeah. It can't be any naturally, you know, produced sunscreen that you're
I mean, everyone's taken a vaccine that isn't FDA approved.
That's an excellent point. That is an excellent point. Yeah.
Shh, we don't say the quiet part out loud.
Yeah. That's my inside voice. So I thought that was just, and it just boggles your mind. Like from cradle to grave, they want to control everything you can do. And that's indoctrinating kids, right? Like,
yeah.
Johnny wants to put sunscreen on his nose, or Susie wants to put sunscreen on her ears so she doesn't get a burn. But you have to go get permission from the authority, the nurse, to say that you can do this. You have to go, you know, nurse Jane, you know, may I put some sunscreen on my nose? Like, unbelievable.
And that's another barrier to that, right? So then not, you know, during those years, kids are forming habits and things like that. So they're going to get to, you know, my age and be like, I don't need sunscreen, whatever. So what's the long-term effects of the government saying, no sunscreen for you in school, you know, especially during most of their youth.
Right. It's
wild.
Just, yeah. It's just,
I don't even know how this
I don't
got
have
in
much
there.
More to say on that one other one that I just popped out to me. I was like, what the hell is going on here?
Like, well, I'm glad someone's kind of cleaning it up.
Yeah. I'll give them kudos.
Silver lining.
You're right. But it's just the fact that it was even a thing, you know, that needs to be addressed. So the next one, speaking of children, right? So politicians running for office or serving, in their various capacities, if they get elected, have to deal with childcare, right? If you got to go to your...
Well, I think anyone has to deal with childcare with whatever activity you do.
Everybody that works, right? Like, yeah. Even people that don't work, you know, people looking for jobs, like, you know, got to deal with childcare, right? Like it's just a fact of life.
It's infrastructure.
Yes. So this bill, written by Justine Caldwell, another fine, upstanding, you know, representative at the state house, scumbag, And Gail Golden, and wasn't it Caldwell, the one that said that she received threats from the 2A community? Was that her?
That was her. Yeah.
But didn't produce any evidence whatsoever.
Nothing. No, she ended up walking out on some of the stuff. Yeah. She's something.
Yeah. I'm still waiting on that one. So they propose this bill. It says allow candidates for office to use campaign funds for childcare while they're participating in a campaign or office holder activities. So while, if they get elected and they're doing their thing. So now they're allowed to receive their campaign donations and use that for personal use, right? Not for campaign related stuff or stuff, you know, that it's for taking care of their children. And like, if you're representing a constituency and you can't figure out how to manage childcare for your family, maybe you've got some organizational problems that you need to work out before you decide to run for office.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's just me.
You know what I think that's a huge slippery slope, because then you got people contributing to your campaign to offer you a personal service at that point, right? If they're handing you money to take care of your family. And I think that's a line that can't be crossed when you're a politician for something like that. Imagine someone saying, hey, here's the $1,000 for childcare, because, you know, now I'm doing you a solid because I know you're going to put that towards taking care of your kid.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly right. Right. So what happens when, you know, John Smith comes to you and says, hey, I need you to, you know, look at this legislation. I'd like you to take a look at it. And she's like, well, I would, but I just don't have the time because, you know, my kids, I don't have daycare for my kids. And, you know, but if you made a donation to my campaign fund,
that is so dangerous,
you know, like I might be able to do that for you because I'll have that time. Right. Like it's absolutely insane. Now I should have, but now that I'm thinking, it just kind of popped in my head. I didn't read whether this only applies to female candidates or male candidates. That'd be interesting. And I didn't put the link to the legislation in my notes.
I want to say when I read some of the surrounding context, a lot of the reps were given, they were kind of focused on that. You know, we can't get women involved in politics because this is the barrier to entry. So it may not say that explicitly, but their intent, and I think intent behind the legislators is really important and saying, yep, well, this because of this, it's going to affect women. And because of even worse than that, it's going to affect minority women because of these situations that we're putting folks in. And this will allow more people to participate. But the state does a whole lot more to stop normal Rhode Islanders from participating in the political Mike, you've talked about ballot access issues on previous episodes, you know, things like that. So if they want to lift up more voices and offer a more diverse, equitable and inclusion in terms of the political scene, there's a whole lot more that the legislators and the Secretary of State can do to really do that. And all they got to do is one line a whole bunch of different, you know, things that are in place now. So this isn't what's stopping people.
Right. Exactly. No, exactly right. So to this point, I guess Caldwell's comment on it was, while child care can be a concern for potential candidates of any gender, it is a consideration that can deter many women from running for office. Guaranteeing the legitimacy of using campaign funds in this way can help to encourage more women to run. So it's as if, you know, it's definitely a slanted perspective here, but yeah, what if you're a single dad? You know what I mean? I grew up with a single dad. My dad, you know, it's like, but again, I don't see where, or I haven't read where it prohibits men from using the,
yeah.
So I'm going to assume that it's for everybody across the board. But then, yeah, now how do we define that, right? Like, how do we define what is daycare? Is there a limit on how much you can spend?
I mean, it's ripe for abuse. I mean, even, you know, if, you know, they could start using it and be like, okay, well, I know I can pocket it because I could get grandma to watch it and grandma can set whatever rate that she wants. And from there, you know, it's more of that in-kind personal service, and it's real shady.
Yeah. And how about the, you know, the caregiver, what's this going to do to the cost of care? You know, that's another interesting thing. But the caregiver decides, okay, I'm going to pay you double and then kick back, you know, something because the, you know, to therefore laundering the money, so to speak, into the candidate's pocket again. I don't know, but
I'm sure it'll lead to some sort of licensing requirement for you to take care of a politician's or potential candidate's child. You have to do all these reporting requirements and this and that. And there'll be a small group of people that figure out the rules and offer this. And then that'll just be, like you said, the funnel for a lot of bad stuff.
Yeah. It's just bizarre. So the next one I got before, we got two more here, charging stations. So vehicle charging, this kind of goes in line with what you talk about a lot with the whole energy, all this other crap that's coming down the avenue here very shortly. I can assure us. So the General Assembly has passed legislation produced by Joseph McNamara and Frank Lombardo the III that calls for statewide electric vehicle charging station infrastructure.
Yikes.
So the bill would require the Department of Transportation, along with the DMV and the Office of Energy Resources, to develop a plan for statewide electrical vehicle charging station infrastructure in order to make those stations more accessible to the public. This is an important legislation, says McNamara, if we're going to achieve our goal of reducing carbon emissions in the state. This plan will go a long way towards encouraging Rhode Islanders to purchase electric vehicles. It's critical that people who live away from urban areas have access to charging stations. Implementing the plan would make us a leader in New England, right? That's so important, to be a leader in New England. So the deadline for this is the formation of the plan would be January 1st of 2022. So what's that? You know, 5-6 months away. Representative McNamara also foresees the charging station infrastructure as a boon to Rhode Island tourism industry by encouraging travel to the state for those with electric vehicles. So again, now it doesn't say they have to be in place. They're just coming up with a plan to get this there. Of course, we know that the next step of the plan is to implement the plan, but I just bizarre, right? Again, we know there's an issue with electric vehicles in and of themselves. If you're truly environmentally friendly, And I love technology, right? I think electric cars are cool. Tesla, like I think all that kind of stuff, the innovation is great. But there are problems, right? The manufacturing of the battery and the batteries and the disposal of the batteries and all the other electronic waste, e-waste that's generated from electric vehicles, like all that other stuff nobody's talking about yet.
You know, is this a is this a real problem in Rhode Island, though? You know, is this the growing demand? Because I have a feeling if there was a strong demand for this, folks would be popping up these types of things all That's over right. the place to accommodate, right? And we've already got enough energy issues as it is. We're already throwing a bunch of money. If you guys check out one of our previous podcast episodes where we talked about renewable energy mandate by 2030, you know, I don't think this is as big of an issue. I wonder how, you know, when we're spending this money, you know, half of it, they're thinking, okay, well, you mentioned tourism, so we're going to get all these electric car owners, which is the market we're going for in Rhode Island, to come and park in Newport or park in Narragansett, and they won't come here unless they have that, right?
Right.
I find that very hard to believe. And, you know, if they're doing this from an infrastructure perspective, oh, well, people in urban settings don't have access to this. You can get anywhere in Rhode Island in 45 minutes, right? If you can't get that on a charge, plug it in at night. I don't know.
Exactly.
But I feel like if people are purchasing electric vehicles that are heavily reliant, like a Tesla, yeah. on actual the charge, and it's not a hybrid, people are planning accordingly. That's a part of the ownership of an electric video. You don't need the state to figure out that problem for you. You just like I have to figure out, you know, oh, I need to go get gas today.
Right.
I need to make sure I'm charged up because I'm going to the beach today. It's one of those things where it's, what does Billy say? Solution looking for a problem.
Yeah. It's interesting. Just going back to, I mentioned earlier in the podcast, living in Alaska, right? So yeah. Up there, very cold in the winter, right? You have to plug your vehicles in. They have plug stations like at private businesses. They've decided, well, if I want people to stay in my store, I'm going to provide them with a plug they can plug their car in, so they can stay in there longer and shop longer and spend more money and blah, blah, blah. So the market is determining, you know, this is a plus to me. So maybe you're, you know, I don't know, whatever type of store it is. And you say, oh, you know what? If people stop here to charge their car and they plug it in, they're going to come in my store and shop and spend mm-hmm. some money. And maybe it makes sense for me to do this, right?
Like you know,
I'm already seeing opportunity there.
Yeah, I would like to, you know, I haven't listened to it too much. I'd like to see if there are any lobbyists like that were advocating for this. And if you follow the money, I would figure that someone's trying to make a quota to sell some additional charging stations this month.
Or maybe McNamara needs some environmental points under his cap for his reelection, you know, talking points. And he's like, you know what I did? You know, all right. So again, that was another kind of somewhat silly one that just, it was like, again, a solution looking for a problem.
Yeah.
I just don't. So this last one is, you know, the other ones we talked about were kind of silly to a degree, right? They were just kind of nonsensical, but this last one kind of disturbed me a bit. It's property tax breaks for seniors. Again, tax breaks. I love the idea of tax breaks, especially for seniors, people on fixed incomes, you know, so taxes on Social Security, although I think we've done some work on that. It'd probably be a good one to revisit and do some more research on. But another one of my favorite representatives, Jason Knight, scumbag, from District 67 at Warren and Barrington, and Cynthia Coyne, who was another senator, worthless. Wrote a bill to allow seniors to put their time and skills to good use, helping their cities and towns while reducing their property taxes. So besides the obvious financial benefits of both seniors, for both seniors and towns, this is an idea that can also strengthen our communities, creating new opportunities for town residents to meet and interact with their neighbors and helping older residents maintain connections and form new ones in their neighborhood, says Representative Knight. The legislation, which has been transmitted to the governor for a signature, would authorize citizens' towns to establish programs to offer tax credits to property owners age 60 and over in exchange for volunteer hours. While each city and town adopted the city and town adopting the program would set their own parameters, the legislation would allow them to let seniors earn up to $1,500 off their property taxes. So here, I started thinking about this, right? Great. You know, you can give, you know, people, volunteers, seniors that volunteer in the town can get money off their, you know, taxes, which I don't have a problem, generally speaking.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the government is stealing this money from them to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're people on fixed incomes. They're stealing the money to from them to begin with. And now they're saying, well, if you come work for us, we'll give you some of it back. Like, it's almost a form of indentured servitude.
Yeah, it is. And you know what's interesting about that is, like, you know, they want to you know, quote unquote, pay them for this now, but they're not offering them anything else that they make any other employer provide to them, whether it be benefits or things like that. So they're getting cheap labor and they're bypassing all these things, you know, for volunteer hours, but there's still someone is putting time and effort and they're coming out and providing a service or a product in the end, but they're able to skate by and not have to do any of that stuff to where they actually have to pay them a wage to perform that service.
Yeah. And there's another thing I was thinking about this. Okay, so what about the seniors that live in housing, right? Like they live in either an apartment or senior housing or something to that effect. They're not paying property tax and they want to volunteer. They're not getting anything, right? Like they're just, you know, whatever, you know, that screw you. You know, that's kind of a weird thing as well. It was just a very...
It's very targeted.
Yeah, it's quite disgusting. I just rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah. No, I don't like the precedent that sets up. I would think a lot of the progressives wouldn't be supporting something like that, to be honest, especially for the whole, you know, there's been a big effort towards, you know, fair wages, you know, equal exchange of labor for a livable wage. And here they are exploiting the most vulnerable, I would think, of our population just to get a few bucks off of their property taxes because they're on a fixed income. I know my property taxes at my town's last cycle skyrocketed, right? Both of my neighbors on each side of me are elderly, so I know their taxes went up. They're on fixed incomes,
right?
So they're probably looking for any opportunity to try to do something like that. So they're trying to create some sort of artificial net gain at the end, but really they're exploiting the elderly here,
right? And what about the you know, those that aren't able to volunteer, right? Yeah. So they don't have a choice, right? They're dangling a carrot here saying, or those that are really hurting for money and shouldn't be volunteering because of health reasons or whatnot, have decided, you know what, I'm going to take that risk and put themselves in jeopardy to try to save some money, you know?
And it's all because of taxes.
Taxes.
That's the thing. That's root cause of it.
That's the root cause. It's something that's being taken from them through force, right? Like, so that they're put in this position by the government to begin with, right? Like it's just a very, I don't know. It just kind of twisted in my mind. Anyway, so that was the last one that I'd had. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on it, but it was
No, but what I will say is there were actually, you know, just to segue into the next topic, I got the two pieces of legislation that didn't go anywhere. Thankfully.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, something that caught my eye in the news cycle, McKee, I thought it was a very interesting trend because you don't hear a lot about this. Usually in our General Assembly, something gets voted on, it gets pushed up, and it's kind of almost a guarantee, it seems these days, that the governor's going to sign it, right? But he actually vetoed two pieces of legislation. So this was refreshing to me to see something like that we're actually slowly starting to draw some sort of line, might be a dotted line, we might keep moving the goalposts, but there's something between the executive and legislative branches there. So the first one was H6066, an act relating to public utilities and carriers and distributed generation interconnection, right? So this one was intended to pose higher levels of scrutiny on renewable energy firms that want to connect to the grid to provide that type of thing to us, to include regulatory and data metric requirements for a renewable source electric utilities to be able to connect to the grid. This would impose additional studies, cost estimates of infrastructure upgrades, accounting reporting requirements, and more government oversight with the establishment and hiring of bodies to be able to adjudicate some of these things. So, McKee voted this one. I want to read a couple of his points verbatim, right? So he said, this bill will have the effect of shifting millions of dollars of costs from developers of renewable energy who sell their power to national grid ratepayers. Ratepayers already pay for renewable energy purchased by national grid for these projects, and as written, this bill would increase those costs with no oversight by any regulatory agency. So it seemed a lot of his issue was, I would be okay with this, but there's no oversight or regulation. So that rubbed me the wrong way. But I think the point here is that it would allow for a broad definition of costs that could be charged against the taxpayers. So there's a couple points, right? So if the government's going to increase the cost of doing business, those costs are going to be factored into the pricing. So that is basic economics there. But this bill seems to be written for these organizations to charge off some of those traditional costs from a different pot of money, another pool of money that's reserved just for that type of stuff that we're paying for, right? So they can kind of charge it off to something else, and they don't have to necessarily front a lot of the capital investments involved with any other industry. If they want to generate growth or a service or a product, they have to make the investment to be able to provide that at some level of scale.
Right.
You know, so here's the opposite side of that argument, though. National Grid controls who the costs and who connects to the grid. Right. So we would just be paying, they would be paying them no matter what side of the fence that they're playing on at that point. It's a self-looking ice cream cone at that point, you know. But this is the situation that we get into when the state has a monopoly on something like this, right?
Yeah.
I guess there are a few renewable energy firms that came out, both supporting and not supporting this, but they all seem to indicate that the process for that interconnection, so they're ready to generate this renewable energy, but the process that National Grid and the state has to actually connect to the grid, it drives up significant costs, project delays, and a bunch of confusion to get approvals, what to do, left hand's not talking to the right. And so it's not just the fact that we don't have enough folks to generate the renewable energy, which, check out our previous episodes, we don't today, because there's really no incentive, but now there's a mandate, right? So we're going to see that trend there. But there's literally bureaucracy behind getting that energy into the grid to be able to do that. And it's the state monopoly that's causing this type of issue.
Right.
You know, so the rest of his justification in the veto wasn't that good. He indicated that, you know, due to the offsetting costs, it would affect local and state and local siting concerns, which I guess factors into some other cost analysis that the Public Utilities Commission, led by a former senior vice president of National Grid, to be able to select that site, and subsequently being approved for a site to, you know, away from the population to conduct this type of activity. There was an interesting statement. I don't know if he knows what it means, but he wrote this up. He wrote, "The legislation also removes a significant cost signal for developers, which may exacerbate state and local siting concerns." So I think that's ironic, right? Considering there's a whole lot of significant cost signals involved in renewable energy right now that are being artificially manipulated by the government when it comes to this whole renewable energy thing. You know,
that's funny.
Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah. Again, it's just them getting their nose into stuff that, you know, they don't need to be there, right? Like, and the fact, like you just said, that the cost, they're distorting the market to begin with. It's just this spider web of, you know.
It's one signal that's just diluted in all the rest of the white noise.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So we'll talk about the other veto that he did, right? So it had to do with restrictions on third-party short-term rentals, like an Airbnb, right?
Yes.
The legislation would have required property owners that participate in that type of thing to register their properties with the state in a database prior to even being allowed to list them online for rent. And then those companies would have to validate, you know, that they were in that database. So, you know, we don't do computer systems very well.
Nope.
Databases in Rhode Island. So
not a good track record.
So if any legislation says database, get rid of it right away. But, you know, McKee, he said this would cause an undue burden on property owners in the state. And I agree with a lot of his points on this, you know. So those supporting the bill were citing things like nationally, we've seen increased violence and safety concerns when renting these types of places instead of like staying at something like a Marriott or something like that. You know, and COVID, you know, we'll have to talk about that. You know, they also said, this is what I thought, so bad. They also said the towns would not be able to adequately tax both the properties and the additional revenue without this type of legislation.
Bingo, and there it is.
Yep. Now, if this had passed, I argue this would have been the start of a real slippery slope. You know, once they make you register, they could then subsequently mandate licensing, additional building inspections, sprinkler systems, you know, for the room you're trying to rent out. You know, funny enough, the Rhode Island Hospitality Association, which is sponsored by companies like Marriott, they supported the bill.
Oh, go figure.
You know, I wonder why. Yeah. That right there is
cronyism.
That is textbook Rhode Island cronyism for you. Yeah, this is a way for a larger hotel industry. And we were just talking, you were talking about tourism. We're going to get all the tourism with the electric chargers, right? Well, you know, on the opposite side of there, the larger hotel industry wants to eliminate their competition. Yep. You know, I argue that Airbnb and those types of third-party things has kind of disrupted that industry that's more traditionally been like you go to to a traditional brick and mortar hotel for either your office travel, your leisure, and all those things. And that was pretty traditional. And then this happened, and there are a lot more options and a lot more choices for people to take there, and subsequently much more competition. Because you know, someone like Airbnb doesn't have to make the investments. They provide the platform for that, and they're able to skim off the top. You know. So they used to have the majority of the market share, and now it's starting to go away. So just like any other thing, right?
What happens, right? Like that. So they put all these taxes on hotels room, drive the cost of hotels up, you know, hotel rooms up. So someone comes out with an alternative to counter that, and now they want to squash the alternative because and of course, just going to the tax thing, which we know, you know, obviously this is going to, you know, boil down, or would have boiled down to, is the towns aren't just cities and towns aren't just happy enough with the additional tourism coming into the town and those people going out to the restaurants and buying, you know, whatever souvenirs and paying the sales tax on that and all that other stuff. They need to find more revenue. Like they need more, you know.
Once they find out that your property in their town is registered in that database, you know, hey, so you are now renting.
Yeah.
And then that they can try to impose additional taxes, and they can grab that from you.
Your property tax is not enough, right? Like you're paying the property tax on the house or wherever you're renting.
But you're using it for something we didn't intend. Right.
And we need more, you know? Yeah.
So it's just one of those things where they have an incentive for that. And then, you know, the local person, if all of a sudden they have to install a sprinkler system inside of their, you know, personal home or their summer home or whatever they're using their property for, that's another barrier to entry. Be like, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to seek out that additional type of revenue. It's another opportunity lost in Rhode Island for something like that. I think something like Rhode Island is great for something like that. We want to, if anything, the state should be doing they shouldn't be getting in the way of the tourism. They always tout the tourism. This is, we want out of state dollars. We want people to come here. Rhode Island is gorgeous. We've got the best food. We've got great beaches. We've got that type of scene, but they're putting things that are stopping people from going into this.
Yep.
And it's that approach towards that. It just blows my mind.
They did the same thing with Uber, right? Who was the biggest fight against Uber? Were the taxi,
you know, yellow taxi
taxis, cabs, and it's just, the gig economy, basically, right? Like everything, every time something pops up that's innovative and more efficient and more convenient for the consumer, you know, it's got to be squashed, you know.
And this isn't just like a tourism or hospitality industry thing. You can see this in like the automotive industry. You'll see the lobbyists advocating for a new regulation, which would make them, you know, and do more cost, but really they want their competitors to have to meet that safety requirement or this feature that they've already kind of developed and they could go and implement really quickly. And no one else in their current model years, they'd have to do all this retooling, re-engineering, and all this thing to meet those types of mandates. And they've already figured it out. They made that investment, and then they'll be able to comply with it. So they're just trying to bury out competition.
It happens in every industry. Like minimum wage is another big one. Like Walmart and Target and those are the big companies, they don't care about the minimum wage. They actually want it because then it just squishes, you know, it pushes out their competition, the mom and pop shop that can't afford it, right? They can't compete. They can't. You know, they can't react to that. The tech industries, Facebook and Twitter and all, they want regulation on the internet because it gets rid of their competition. So like we see it over, and it's plain as day. And I don't know why people don't understand it. They need more regulation. No, they can adapt to that regulation. They've got armies of lawyers. They'll figure it out. Money's no object. They don't care.
Yeah. So, you know, just one final fun fact on the vetoes, right? So, we'll talk about a quick history of it. So there were no vetoes by Raimondo in 2020.
Interesting.
And from the rest of her time, from 2016 and 2019 there, she had 11 of them.
11 vetoes.
And before that, Chafee had a total of 21 vetoes from 2011 to 2014. So it's not as common of an occurrence, you know, it looks like it's trending down, you know, from Chafee down to Raimondo. Obviously, no one went against Raimondo in 2020. Mm-hmm. That's, you know.
Yeah. I guess credit where it's due, right? You know, give credit to McKee for, you know.
Yeah.
Now, are these veto-proof legislation?
Well, that's the thing. And, you know, what we could do is look at the voting records for it, because it could just be him making some sort of stance. But really, for most of the voting that's been going on, it's been on party lines, right? So based on the political climate of Rhode Island, most of these probably would go through and be able to override that veto. I think it's good that he took stances on these. Ever since he came on, we're always optimistic, right? Anything's better than Raimondo, but yeah, it's we'll have to see. I would argue that what's going to be interesting to see is do they try to fight this now? Do they wait to retool it and perhaps they modify some of these? I doubt they're going to cancel them. This will go back into the hopper.
Oh yeah,
and they'll push it through, and they'll either decide nope, we're going to push it through with a majority vote, or we'll make some amendments.
Even this last one that you just mentioned with the rent database I seem to recall that being discussed before in years past. So
yeah.
Yes, I'm sure it's not its first go. Although they're getting closer, it seems. It's just a matter of time. Same thing with the gun legislation that they push. There was a bunch of that too we didn't get into. I considered it, but we got limited time. But it's interesting. Just actually, let's hit on it. We got a little bit of time, unless you got anything else.
No.
One that was interesting was the one that did get passed was the straw purchase legislation, meaning that someone buys a gun on behalf of somebody else, right?
Yeah.
And then just gives it to them. That's already illegal in Rhode Island.
Yeah.
I think it's already illegal under federal law. Don't quote me on that one. I'm pretty sure it is, but it's certainly illegal in Rhode Island just by the mere fact that private transfer is not allowed in Rhode Island anyway.
Yeah.
So again, a problem, a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. Like even if I can't give it to you, we have to go down the street to the gun shop, give it to, John at competition shooting and say, hey, John, you need to do the FFL transfer between me and Sean. So you still have to do that. You can't do like the gun show loophole, essentially, which also applies to straw purchase transfers.
Yeah.
It's that quote unquote, I hate to use the term, loophole is already been closed in Rhode Island. Right.
Yeah.
So I thought that was just silly. Of course, Rep Kazarian, another, wonderful representative. I've had her on my porch before, and you kept her from going to other houses and arguing back and forth.
Yeah.
She, oddly enough, she's never come back to my porch again.
Oh, really? I wonder why.
I'm on a list.
Oh, geez.
All right. So I guess that wraps it up.
I think so.
Yeah. Hope Bill's having a good time out with his family and, enjoying some freedom up. Yeah. Up north.
Absolutely.
But we'll be back at it here in another couple of weeks. But most importantly, if you guys want to connect with us, please do. Please do. And you can always connect with us, find all of our links to all our social media, our contact form, if you want to shoot us an email, at libertyri.com/connect. Of course, join us at libertyri.net. It's kind of slowed down there a little bit. We'll see if we can get that picked up some more. But libertyri.net, which is our own social community, if you will, that has no influence by the big tech companies. And then the podcast itself, you can subscribe to us on Apple, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, all the major podcatchers that are out there. Don't forget to rate and leave a review. We've got a couple on there, so that's great. Some of you guys have been doing that, guys and girls. We did have a little issue. Somebody, I guess, had mentioned that they couldn't find us on Apple, but we double checked it. We are up on there and provided that link, so we're good to go.
Yeah, and with that social media, right, we're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, so you guys can pick your poison.
Exactly.
Follow us.
Yep. And till next time, stay safe.
All right, see you next time.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Rhode Island Liberty Report. Be sure to check us out at libertyri.com.